your hosts. I'm Brian.
And I'm Aaron.
And we are at hairmetalmemoriesiowa@gmail.com, or you can message us at Facebook and on our Facebook page. And please do so. We always love hearing from you, as usual. We had a little break there.
Yes, there was a little bit of a delay. So I suppose there's the whole thing. See, about 3-4 weeks ago, we were pretty well lined up to get the next episode going. And what happened is my girlfriend went into labor a month early. And so we now have a kid. So I've been a little bit busy with that. So thank you for your patience. They demand a bit of your time.
Yeah. And congratulations on bringing a little rocker into the world. Yeah. So that's big news in our little world. We've got some other news too. We have an update. Last time we mentioned that we're going to Rocktemberfest up north of Minnesota
or north of Minneapolis.
We've got kind of an update on that. We pitched for media passes and we got them. So we're
excited.
Yeah, we're excited. We're gonna go see this. Is it
two days
of hair metal, and we're gonna hopefully get to interview people and be able to share some of those interviews with you guys, which we're so excited about.
That's absolutely
next level stuff for us.
The number of bands at it that we've talked about on this show, I mean, it's ridiculous. I think we went over them last episode too. So yeah, this is a really awesome opportunity. Kind of excited.
Yeah. So more on that in the somewhat near future. We also got tickets to go see Tesla here in Iowa.
Really pumped to go see Tesla. Yeah,
and I sent the venue an email and asked them for media passes, and I haven't heard anything back yet. So if you guys would cross your fingers for us, we'd sure appreciate that.
Hope.
Yeah, we would love to say, hey, we've got an interview with Tesla. Here you go. But we'll see. And we also started making hair metal memory shirts, which for those of you who follow our Facebook page, we posted pictures of that and stuff like that. If you're interested in a hair metal memories shirt, you can email us again at hairmetalmemoriesiowa@gmail.com or message us on Facebook and we'll work that out. We're very DIY. We don't have any kind of website with a store. We'll have to say, hey, you can Venmo us money for it. We're selling shirts for $20 with the little logo of the guitar pedal on it that has our names and the name of the podcast.
The traditional logo.
Yeah.
As it were.
But on with the hair metal, today we are featuring a hair metal legacy nugget that's not as well known.
A good way to describe that. a legacy nugget. That is very correct.
Yeah. The band is called London and their album's called Nonstop Rock.
I'm sure a bunch of y'all know who London were. And for those of y'all who don't know, this will be fun.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely a little under the radar in this one, but once we get done talking about it, I think you'll know why we were excited about it. This album is not available on Spotify.
It's not available anywhere, hardly.
Yeah, the version I listened to was on YouTube. So I'm going to, after we get this episode up, we'll post the album on from the YouTube link for it so you guys can listen to it and check it out. Because we're going to talk about the album and all the songs on it. It'd be nice to have a reference point.
Sure.
And we don't have the ability to play samples from it this time. So, you're just stuck with us. Sorry about that. does this album pass the hair metal smell test?
Oh, boy, and how does it ever?
Yes, it does in a defining way. This was one of the templates, I would say, for what hair metal is.
It just ends up being a template running a little bit behind everybody else because of issues that we will be getting into.
Right. So a little bit of history. This is London's first album. It's released in 1985 on Shrapnel Records. So we should talk about Shrapnel Records.
Right. And that's going to stick out because this is probably the only album we're ever going to talk about on Shrapnel unless someday we decide we're going to talk about like Cacophony or Hawaii or, somebody like that, Richie Kotzen or something.
Yeah. And we've mentioned Shrapnel before, I'm pretty sure. It was founded in 1980 by Mike Varney. Fun tidbit, Mike Varney co-wrote and performed Rock Justice, which is a song, along with Jefferson Airplane and Jefferson Starship's Marty Balin, which was released by EMI in 1980.
Dang.
Talk about a weirdo connection.
I did not expect that.
Yeah. Shrapnel basically launched the careers of a ton of guitar players, releasing instrumental records by up-and-coming shredders, Paul Gilbert of Racer X and later Mr. Big,
Tony McAlpine, Marty Friedman,
Yngwie Malmsteen,
Jason Becker.
Mike Varney discovered Yngwie Malmsteen at 17, when he was only 17 years old. Vinnie Moore, who'd later join UFO and play on Alice Cooper's Hey Stupid album. Jason Becker, that you mentioned, who played with David Lee Roth. Greg Howe, Richie Kotzen, who you just mentioned, who was in Mr. Big and Poison. A lot of the guitarists fell into sort of a like a neoclassical sort of tradition. So the label became sort of a musician's label, basically.
Very much so.
Yeah, which is why they don't
you
get
saw
talked
a lot
about
of ads for their records in like guitar player magazines. Yeah. And actually, I guess now that I think about it, like Metal Edge and stuff had a lot of shrapnel ads in it. For not talking about many shrapnel bands or artists.
Yeah, and Mike Varney wrote a column in Guitar Player magazine for a while. So and Shrapnel had its ads in all the guitar magazines for all their releases. I have a ton of memories about Shrapnel and their artists and ordered like bunches of their cassettes and stuff like that back in the day because it always seemed like, what is this and why have I never heard of it? And, you know, on and on. And then you'd get them and it would be like, you know, listen to players and be like, how can they play like that? Mike Varney would also later create Blues Bureau Records for it was a blues label, obviously, and Magna Carta, which was sort of a prog rock.
I've heard
label.
Of that one.
And Magna Carta had people like Tony Levin on it and Steve Morse.
Yeah,
and,
wasn't there like a bunch of people like and, you know who would have been on made like bigger labels in the 70s or 80s? He kind of made like a little vanity label so proggers can go live out there.
Yeah, prog records. They released Kansas albums and stuff. So
So, hey, there you go.
Yeah. But in its heyday, Shrapnel put out records by Winger, LA Guns, UFO, Great White, just on and on.
Shrapnel put out a Winger record?
Mm-hmm, they did.
Wow, I did not know that one.
Yeah, I don't remember which one, but that probably later in their career would be my
guess. I'm guessing it has to be, because they were a major label band for those first few...
Yeah, because Shrapnel still exists, and my guess is that it became a home for when hair metal sort of like, you know, became less of a thing. I'm guessing that a lot of these artists found a home on Shrapnel.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But that's a quick little, you know, tidbit about Shrapnel Records. But let's talk about London. They were formed in Hollywood in 1985 by Lizzie Gray.
Well, that's the second time around.
Oh, the second time around? Oh,
they
okay.
originally formed in 1978. With Lizzie Gray, Nikki Sixx, and Dane Rage.
Okay.
And the thing is, in that period, the 78 to 81 period, is when one guy joins, another guy leaves, one guy joins, another guy leaves. By 79, they'd already seen some turnover. A couple of the members of which are now deceased. So it's Sixx and Benjamin ended up leaving the band because they were tired of all the changeover.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah, if you look at the history of this band, it's just like a long list of people that have been in it.
And so after Nikki Sixx left, they got Blackie Lawless to take his place. Mm-hmm. And that didn't last long because obviously he jumped ship to Wasp.
Yeah.
And they kind of folded in like 81. They kind of just went dormant for a while. And when Lizzie Gray dug it back up in 84... Then we start getting a whole another rash of people who were in the band for like a hot minute. Izzy Stradlin was in the band for a minute before he jumped ship for a band that we all know much better.
Yeah.
There was a drummer named Bobby Marks who, I mean, he actually played on the record we're talking about, but he left and was in the first lineup of Keel.
Mm-hmm.
For all y'all who remember Keel. Pictured and credited on this album but did not play is Fred Curry. He actually has kind of a running thing of being credited on albums that he didn't play on. and
he's mostly known for Cinderella. Of
course, known for Cinderella. And then you also have Steven Adler for a hot minute before he jumped ship for a band that we all know much better. And now there was the crazy thing is there were some demos that got recorded and Bob Welch was involved in the recording of them.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Like, what the hell?
Yeah. Talk about this is, and that's sort of the whole history of this band, basically, is that they had so many touches with greatness, but they never got there themselves.
They keep putting a lineup together, the lineup falls apart. They put their lineup together, it falls apart.
Yeah. And everybody went off to
everybody
start a bigger
else band. Goes on to be in a platinum band. It's kind of ridiculous. Well, I guess Keel never made platinum, but
we're fairly well known.
I'm pretty sure Keel had a record out before London did, because I think, because the dude who was Keel, Ron Keel, he had wasn't he in Steeler, I think, maybe? So he was already plugged in. But yeah, so literally, everybody except for this band got big in this band, or from this band.
Fun Lizzie Gray tidbit, his maternal uncle was radio commentator Wally George, who was active in the 40s and 50s, so probably not a lot of people have heard of him. And he also wrote an episode of Bonanza.
Hey.
And he was the cousin of actress Rebecca De Mornay. Going down all the rabbit holes and stuff, I learned during this research, dated Harry Dean Stanton. I didn't know Rebecca De Mornay dated Harry Dean
Stanton. Nor did I. Wow.
And I'm a big fan of both of those actors.
That's
so,
just like so much 80s in one spot right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned the Blackie Lawless connection. I think we should cover Wasp sometime, by the way.
We probably should cover Wasp sometime.
Yeah. Yeah, and then Nikki Sixx met Tommy Lee, and then they went off to form Motley Crue during this time. And on the debut, Too Fast for Love, which we covered not too long ago, Motley Crue released a song that Nikki Sixx and Lizzie Gray had written but never recorded with London, entitled Public Enemy Number One. Blackie Lawless played bass for them for a bit. I didn't know Blackie Lawless played bass until this.
And it confused me because, I was always like, I remember him as a guitar player.
But... Yeah. Yeah, so I thought that was interesting. You know.
And a fun fact is at one point, London was managed by Eric Grief, who was the manager for one of my favorite bands, Death, later on. So just that's how that plays out.
Yeah. Yeah, and then in 1988, London appropriately appeared in the Penelope Spheris film The Decline of Western Civilization II, The Metal Years, and they described their band as a training school for rock stars. Which is amazing.
They're not wrong. And if you haven't seen that movie, everybody, please go track it down and watch it. It's super great. Yeah. I mean, honestly, all three volumes of Decline of Western Civilization are absolutely worth your time. It's just that this one is...
close to home.
Just, it's wild.
Yeah. Yeah, so I kind of came to the conclusion that London is sort of like the linchpin of hair metal cross-references. And in my head, I compare them like how Deep Purple is for British metal.
That's fair,
you know.
Deep Purple got to touch a lot more success.
Yeah, they did.
You know,
that's true. That's the one way that.
I mean, because you know, when you think about like all the people who left this band, they got signed to Mercury, Geffen, Elektra.
Yeah,
I don't remember where Keel ended up being. I think they might have been on Shrapnel actually too. Maybe I don't remember now, but just. Were just, because of the hemorrhaging of band members, they were just sort of always like a step or two behind all the other bands.
That's what it seemed like. They were so close to getting an ultimate lineup, and then like the bands went off to other ultimate lineups, or the members went off that way.
I mean, just think of what this band could have been at some point if just the right people had stuck together. It would be like a weird...
Yeah.
You could have had like a band that had like Lizzie Gray, Izzy Stradlin, Fred Curry, Nikki Sixx.
Yeah.
You know, like assuming that just certain... Yeah. Things worked out the way they did. So weird.
Yeah, it's like almost a supergroup.
Yep.
But after a decade, two albums, 19 different members, and very little commercial success, Lizzie Gray left London in 1988, and he passed away in 2019.
Louis body dementia.
Yeah, the band continued on without him, but mostly fizzled out, and they've had some reunions and things like that.
The singer from this album that we're going to talk about is still fronting the band to this day.
Oh, that's cool.
I haven't heard anything. I haven't heard anything about this band in so long.
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of figure we probably won't be covering any other London albums, so that's why we're going deep on the history of this band here, because we're not likely to talk about them again other than in passing as a reference.
And honestly, most of the big thing about this band is just that everybody left the band to go be in a huge band.
Yeah, so. Nonstop Rock was self-produced by the band, but recorded and partially mixed by Brett Newman, who has a very weird pedigree.
I was looking him up as we were digging into this, and he's kind of... And this was actually, I believe, it's his first engineering job.
Yeah, but he's also worked with Animotion, which was like sort of a weirdo one.
And Red Cross, one of like the most awesome little punk bands out of South...
Yeah. And Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Blind Melon.
Hans Zimmer.
J.J. Cale. Ron Keel. He did some assistant engineering on a Dio anthology.
Yeah.
So, like, he's just all over the place.
He is, but to go from like Nick Cave to Hans Zimmer and Animotion and then end up on, and start out with hair metal. It's like, talk about auspicious beginnings and stuff.
I wonder what that had to be like too, because there was no producer in that room. They took care of themselves with him engineering and like...
Yeah, and there was another guy that is also credited with mixing named Steve Fontano. He's more what I would expect. He worked with Tony McElpine and Racer X and Marty Friedman, but he also worked with Cher, and he has a Prince credit. And he's also worked with Clapton and Rod Stewart, The Grateful Dead, Jimmy Cliff, and he did Santana's Supernatural album, the one that put Santana on the map. I mean, this guy, if you look at his credit,
he probably
it's
doesn't
on
have to work anymore.
He probably wouldn't have to work anymore. Wow. He's all over the place. Yeah. Yeah, so they had this weird dream team super group
there's
thing.
A lot of people involved who think would, I don't know.
So it makes me wonder if the thing they were lacking was like a marketing guru or something, because everybody else that was around them and everything was top-notch shit.
It's because they couldn't put a sticker on their album that says formerly featuring themselves.
Yep, missed it by a year, like in every case or something.
Yikes.
What are your memories of this album?
Oh, nothing. I knew nothing about this album until later. I don't remember when I first found out about it, but I'm pretty sure it was probably through MTV.
Okay.
And either that or it was like the rock mags. I want to say, because I was also like a pretty loyal Metal Edge reader, and I'm guessing that there was probably some little thing about, hey, you know, this guy was in this band and or something, you know, I saw Decline at one point. And
they get name dropped a lot.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's almost hard to pinpoint where this one floated into my head, because I remember more of the story of everybody leaving than I do when I was introduced to him. Because I didn't end up hearing this album until, I don't know, 3 years ago maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Was my first exposure to it, beyond the clips of them performing that you hear in the Decline documentary.
Yeah.
So how about you?
Yeah. Kind of the same. I really don't have many memories of this. I remember seeing them in Decline of Western Civilization, but it didn't stick, in all honesty. And they come off as a little bit of a joke in the movie, I thought.
They're not the only band that does in there.
Yeah, a lot of the bands come off as a joke. What was the one that's in the hot tub? And they talk about how they want to make music that will last forever, and you've never
exactly.
And you've
who's
never
that
heard of
band?
That band?
Yeah, exactly. I have no fucking idea.
I can't remember what the name of it is.
There was a band in that movie called Seduce, and I went to the trouble of actually trying to look up some of their albums to see if I could acquire one at one point. And yeah, it got expensive, because it turns out when you were one of those tiny little bands that got on a tiny little label and made a tiny little record, they're hard to track down now.
Yep, that makes sense. Yeah, but so I don't have a lot of memories. I think if anything, probably you turned me onto this album, where I may have seen the name, you know, like in the movie and in other places and reference, but it never really registered with me. So I hadn't even listened to it much until we got ready to do this podcast.
That's right, everybody. We did some digging. We have already given you warrant. Now it's time to eat your vegetables.
That's right.
So yeah. We gave you the strawberry shortcake first, and then we saved the asparagus. Yeah. Sorry, but you know, sometimes there's just things you gotta know.
Yeah, exactly. But don't worry, we've got some desserts in store for you in the future.
Yes, we do.
And thanks for bearing with us. Let's dig into the album.
Let's do.
Side one, we start off with Dirty City.
You recognize that riff?
I did, yeah.
It's Keep Your Eye on the Money by Motley Crue.
Yeah, there's a lot of crossover here between those bands, man. Nikki Sixx really is he recycled some ideas, I think.
Now, I don't see him credited as a writer here, so I'm kind of...
I don't either.
But
yeah.
I would still be willing to bet that at some point they were all rocking out together and that riff came up at least for a hot minute, and they each kind of retained a memory of that riff.
Yeah.
Because I think on Theater of Pain, it's just credited to Nikki Sixx and Mick Mars, but I don't have that album in front of me right at the moment. But
yeah, and I think they must have all been good friends, because you don't hear of any lawsuits or anything like that.
I haven't heard any stories of like animosity between them. If any of y'all know any, if you've heard anything, totally let us know. But
if you've got dirt, send it to us. Dirty City, my first note on this was, that's a lot of reverb.
It is. I mean, the whole mix is
on the whole track, it sounds like. The whole thing is reverb.
I mean, it's a good opening song, and it rocks hard.
Yeah.
But, boy, it just, like...
Yeah, they really got fond of the reverb, and they thought, let's sound big and, you know, airy and stuff. And kind of the whole record's a little bit like
that. A lot of my comments on this album were you know, they probably could have used a producer.
Right, they could have.
Because, you know, they had to do a lot of decision-making on their own, and, you can kind of tell.
Right. There's a great guitar breakdown section that I would normally play here, but, again, we couldn't find the album. So no samples this time. And this song, not super great lyrics. It seems to be about sexualizing a city.
I mean, but, you know, it almost
we're in the early years of hair metal, though. So
it's almost to the point where it kind of makes it feel like almost like a joke commentary on all the songs that do things like that.
Yeah,
but it isn't.
Right,
it's just one of those songs. But it's like, I don't know.
Yeah, and we'll see a bit of a trend of this, I think, you know, as we go on.
Yeah.
Then we've got Nonstop Rock, which is the title track. There's a great riff on this one, and
it is a good riff. Like they
know their way
around.
They
came up with good riffs.
Yeah, and the vocals sound huge on this.
And I thought that the chorus like totally has like a Twisted Sister feel to it. That sounds like a Twisted Sister chorus when you think about it.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. These, and again, pretty terrible lyrics. I wanted to call them out, even because...
Oh, please do so.
I got your kitty purring and my love gun's hot. Well, won't you give me a kiss and I'll lick the spot?
And what's even funnier is it's almost...
It's so veiled.
It really seems like that's like a straight up kiss lift, man.
It kind of does, yeah.
There wasn't a kiss song with that exact, grouping in it.
All I can really say, and I know people say this a lot, is it was a different time.
That's true. And then the other thing I noticed is that like the solo in this song is weirdly like back in the mix.
Yeah, it is.
Like,
yeah,
a producer would have been like, dude, this is your moment,
right?
Like, why is this like hidden behind this wall of reverb?
Yeah, it's a great breakdown section, and it's got like drum hits and guitar dive bombs and then a really cool like spacey section to it.
Yeah, so some of the writing is actually, you know, like musically, it's like, wow, you kind of came up with some cool little twists and turns here. All right, but
yeah, there's some cool stuff that he does with his voice on this tune too, like screams and moans and whatnot. And so he really was like doing some emoting stuff that was probably pretty cutting edge, I would guess.
If any of y'all have heard this band play, anybody who's like in a bigger city or a place where this band has played, and you've heard this guy sing recently, please let us know how it is, because like, I'm just so curious, because you know.
Yeah, he went for it on the album.
You see a lot of guys who still have their voices and a lot of them that
don't
have their voices anymore. And we don't need to get into that right at the moment. I was just curious about that.
We're not talking about Motley Crue, right?
No, that wasn't me. That was actually a pre-recorded tape about Motley Crue. Okay, sorry.
Then we've got Werewolves in London.
Completely unrelated to Warren Zevon.
Yeah, not the Warren. And this is a song about being like a werewolf, only thirsting for love instead of blood. It seems to be like,
So which is the more unhealthy thirst?
Yeah,
I guess I'm not really sure in this context. Because with a werewolf, it's going to...
Probably depends on the outcome.
It's going to be rough either way, I think.
Yeah. They chant wild in the streets. I thought that part was cool.
I liked that too. I just thought it was weird because I was like...
Yeah.
Huh. So it's like it's
the chanting hair metal thing.
It's the anthem part of the chorus, and then like the title is just kind of a thingy. Is just sort of like an emphasis term in between.
They should have called the song "Wild in the Streets."
It's interesting.
Yeah. Oh, lots and lots of reverb again.
And once again, I said this is actually a pretty badass tune that would sound so much better if they had a producer.
Yeah.
Because you know what's crazy? This was recorded at Sound City, man.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
This is a no bullshit studio they were at.
Right.
And I'm guessing
high-level people,
you know, and an engineer, I don't know what the dynamic was like back then, but like an engineer is just an engineer, so he's just sort of like, is this what you want captured? Okay. So like, it would have been nice for somebody to bounce some of these sound ideas off of, man, because like, I mean, you're not making a shoegaze record. You can ease back on that fucking reverb knob, man.
I wonder if they had like bad management or something. I don't know.
I mean, don't know.
It doesn't seem like steering their own ship and they're steering their own ship into the rocks.
And like Mike Varney didn't feel the need to like give him somebody. He either hissed at himself or be like, hey, why don't y'all get another person? Because they hadn't made a record or anything. So they got to self-produce their own first record. It's just.
Yeah. And Mike Varney he's no slouch. He has production.
This has to be one of the things that helped Deep Six them, right? I mean.
I think so too. Honestly.
That has to be.
The sound of the record itself is a little. It's not typical for this kind of genre.
No, not at all.
But on this tune in particular, this is really where I'm hearing the glam influence. And I think these guys were pretty early adopters of that in terms of like the hair metal sound. I remember reading that Kim Fowley produced their second album. And you can kind of hear why based on, you know, right here on this song and on this album, too. You can hear how they would influence hair metal. And I thought this song
in
particular.
Now I want to see if I can find that next album. I've never heard the second album.
Yeah, I haven't heard the second one either. I was just in digging in the history of it. But I feel like this song in particular is a template for hair metal in a way, just because of the glam factor.
Oh yeah, everything about it fits right in with
like huge vocals and cool guitar arrangement stuff. Though here it's more muted mostly because of the reverb and production than what it would become later. But I can see where Kim Fowley would be like, oh man, I'm the glam guy. These guys are a glam band. You know, I can hear it. I just need to bring it out. Yeah,
In other words, he was like, you know, you can have room tone.
Yeah, right. The next song is called simply It's Rock and Roll. Another cool riff, and everything's sounding big again.
What I said was, how did Sound City produce such a muted drum tone?
Yeah, this is a song celebrating rock and roll. They list off all the rocking cities.
I do like, did you notice that for the chorus, they switch to like a swing for the chorus?
Yeah.
And move back out of the swing, back to just like, you know, rocking out for... Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Verses. That's neat.
Yeah.
I thought, and one of my comments was, you can totally tell, like, if they toured, I don't know how broadly they toured, but when they did, they would change the name of the cities. You know it.
Yeah, you know they had to have done that.
Pasadena.
Yeah.
There's no way they didn't change the names.
And then they get, after listing off all the cities, they get to the chant where they say, London rocks, which is a little self-aggrandizing, but you need to do that in this, you know? And I thought that was kind of cool that they... It's almost like they listed all the other cities so that they could brag about themselves.
It was both the town and the band. Look at
that's
that.
Right.
Hey-o.
Yeah. Another great bridge section on this. You know, the guy's a great screamer, I think. Like, you know, he's got a really good scream. And this tune has a fade out, so of course we have to say, suck it, Blue Jack.
Suck it, Blue Jack.
Then we've got Stand Back. Which is a nice driving tune all the way. I could not figure out what the hell this song's about, though.
No. I gave it points for being a good side closer.
Yeah.
Like, as far as, like, what something should sound like when you're getting done with a side.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I like the guitar solo a lot on this one, too. It sounds like the band's raging on this one. And tempo-wise, it's a burner. And I had the same note that it's a
My
great
thought
way to
was
close
I could totally picture it being played at, like, the Whiskey A Go-Go or like, Gazzari's or something like that back in the day.
Yeah.
I can picture it totally, I like that we finished a whole side with no ballads. I was very happy about that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
You know, some bands were like, well, we should have at least one aside, right?
Yeah. Yeah, this is kind of like pre-ballad hair metal or something, maybe. I don't know.
Well, arguably, yes. Because, I mean, you know, we did that whole episode about power ballads and everything.
Yeah.
And
I don't remember the dates of when those came out compared to 1985.
Right. But, you know, they were working. They were probably working on this album as Theater of Pain was becoming stratospheric. Yeah. And I mean, there were songs before it and everything. But it doesn't seem like it was until, like, about Home Sweet Home that people started, like, really heavily pushing power ballad as being one of the singles. So they probably just missed that whole thing. And then you get people like Rat who just didn't do ballads.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think, like, in the early days, the ballad was sort of, like, tucked away on the album. And you listen to, like, the rocking hits. And
it was almost always just an album track.
Yeah, and the ballad was kind of, like, for the fans. It was a deep cut.
But it really wasn't until then that they started getting pushed as either the thing you need to lead with or, like, your second single. Because you also saw that pattern, you know, with bands for a while where there was – kind of like the rockin' first single, then they slip the ballad in.
Yeah,
I don't know. It probably depends largely on which label's running things. You know.
Yeah. Then we now we're on side two, and we start off with No Tell Motel. I couldn't quite tell what this one's about either. It seems to be mostly.
And it's an interesting riff too, because it's like once again, these guys could write some really cool music.
Definitely
like
good
the
musicians.
Actual riff of the song is kind of neat, and it's a little bit different than what you hear in a lot of hair rock. You know, there wasn't like a big strummy like thing down at the bottom keeping it going. He was kind of doing this little finger worky thing that was kind of neat.
Yeah, this one probably has my favorite lyrics of the album, though. It's kind of got like, you know, it seems like it's painting an image of like this Twilight Zone sort of hotel or something. It was hard to tell kind of what's going on, but they're...
Spooky Six!
Yeah. The lyrics are more evocative. The groove on this one, it just gallops,
and
it, you know?
Yeah, and that's actually another thing I noticed on this record that you don't get a lot of in the other hair rock records is this guy actually uses the double bass a few times on the record.
Ooh, I didn't
notice
that.
And you just don't really get a whole lot of that. I mean,
no.
You would see hair rockers with, like, the double bass drum kit, but it's not like...
Yeah, that's more of a full-on metal kind of thing.
Yeah. And once again, oh my God, the toms on this song sound so bad.
Yeah.
Like, they sound digital.
Yeah.
They actually sound like digital toms.
And this is way before digital.
It's so weird because when you listen to them, like you know that somebody with actual sticks in their hands hit toms on a drum kit, and they how did you make them sound like that?
You know, I say this is way before digital, but this could have
been like
digital.
Dire Straits was the first digital recording, and it was done what in 84. Well, the first like mass marketed digitally released album was Brothers in Arms, and that's just like within the year of this.
Yeah, that would have been pretty close.
But I'm guessing this probably wasn't recorded digitally.
Yeah, but I'm forgetting about like digital reverbs and things like that. And so that
could have been
that could have added to some of the tom stuff that you're talking about.
I'm just wondering if they knob twiddled their way to sterility.
That could be. That's probably more likely, honestly.
You know, because like I said, they got to produce their own record. They had an engineer there who's just his job is to be like, "You want me to do what? Okay,
right."
You know. So yeah, I'm guessing a lot of like second guessing. A lot of everybody hovered over the board.
Yeah.
And twiddling everything. And
that reverb sounds so cool. Turn it up.
Yeah, put more of it on everything. Yeah, let's EQ those drums down to just
Yeah. Well, if you get reverb on your voice, I want it on my
drums. It's not even like peak limiting the drums. It's just
There's some cool modal sounding guitar lines on this too. And I do like that title. That's a hilarious title. The No-Tell Motel.
Made me think of the song "Look What the Cat Dragged In" by Poison, because that's the first time I ever heard that phrase.
Yeah, they should make a movie called The No-Tell Motel.
I'm kind of surprised there isn't.
Yeah.
You're going to tell me there's not some B-horror movie somewhere called The No-Tell Motel?
Yeah. It could be the revival thing for London. They could have that be the theme song, and then
there we go. They should do it. If you're listening out there,
all the movie producers listening to our podcast, you know, make
all
sure,
of
make
them.
Sure,
I assure, I assume there's at least an army of them listening.
Yeah, give us a royalty. Then we've got "Party in Hollywood," and this song clocks in at exactly 3 minutes, which I thought was kind of cool. This is a song about partying in Hollywood.
I mean, I don't think we have to dissect it too much more. Right. Like, I feel fairly certain about what we're getting into here.
Yeah, and you know, and to their credit, it does sound like they were having a really good time.
That's the other thing is, all the like the takes themselves divorced from the sound. Like, they're like in there just rocking their fuck out, you know, and it's great.
Yeah, yeah, and I really did buy that they are rock stars in Hollywood, partying all the time, and then they made this record and stuff like that.
And my first comment was, again with the fucking toms.
I like the swagger of this song, though.
Absolutely. It's probably the song's like, still a cool song.
Yeah, it's like the closest to a blues rock influence on it, on the album, I think. It's like a little bit of Aerosmith got in there.
It is kind of impressive for, you know, I mean, because a lot of hair rock bands would touch on bluesy things. And
yeah,
there's only just kind of a little bit of that on here.
Yeah, yeah, and most of it's in this song, and like,
yep,
and great vocal stuff again, like huge screams and stuff like that, and so he really was throwing down on vocals again. Then we got "Masters of the Airwaves," and this one's
my first comment was, time does not agree with this assessment.
True.
But then I said, I suppose hubris really wasn't one of the notable traits of hair rockers.
No. And on this, they actually have like hip hop levels of bragging and stuff.
But now, it does, however, more so than most of the other songs on this album, because it wasn't even a term that crossed my head till I got to this song, was, wow, this one actually sounds like they kind of wanted it to be on the radio.
Yeah. Yeah,
because like a lot of the other songs, it's not necessarily a negative assessment. Just they don't have that sound of like, I want this to be a big single, you know? Because I mean, they didn't release any singles off this record.
No, they didn't.
For wanting to be masters of the airwaves, because my question was, did Shrapnel actually get stuff played on the radio?
It's a good question.
I mean, you know, there's maybe like in the LA markets or something like that, where there's some little radio station, maybe. But I have a hard time picturing like anything Shrapnel on a radio, like, you know.
Me too.
And y'all listen to K-Rock. Can you verify one way or the other?
Yeah, the intro of this one reminds me of something Van Halen would do with that palm muted, verped out, you know, establish the beat kind of like, you know, guitar stuff before it comes in.
So, you know, I mean, once again, they have the ability to just put together all this really cool stuff. And
and nice melodic guitar lead stuff on this one, too. You know,
yeah, Lizzie Gray was a good guitar player. I like his melodic ideas.
Yeah, and I think like was it the Lita Ford episode where we mentioned like how she was a rarity having being like the lead vocalist and the guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have Lizzie Gray kind of like, you know, being an example of that. Like
Didn't sing.
Oh, he didn't
sing. Nadir DePriest was the vocalist.
Oh, yeah.
No,
sorry.
Lizzie Gray. But now on the other hand, he's the only credited guitar player on here. So every melodic idea you hear in here, you know, there was no producer saying, you know what you should try.
Yeah. Because, right.
Yeah. I mean, not to weigh in on that part of anything one way or the other, but yeah, like, so everything you hear is just like, you know, them fucking around and figuring it out.
And then our closing track, Radio Stars.
Again, time is a bitch.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is the Motley Crue crossover one. That's probably the most famous one.
And that's what's bugging me, because they're not mentioning the right song. I looked this up on Wikipedia too. Uh-huh. And it says the riff during the intro song
is for Too Fast for Love.
No, it isn't. Uh-huh. I know Too Fast for Love. What it sounds like, what the intro to Radio Stars sounds like, is if you took that On With The Show arpeggio and just kind of rearranged it a little bit and played it a little bit differently. It sounds a lot more like that, because I was listening and I'm like, what are you talking about for Too Fast for Love? I don't hear it.
Yeah. And this song is, this is probably the most well-known one, if there is such a thing. But, like, this song is excellent. It's, like, super catchy.
It's really good. Awesome chorus.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, it reminded me a lot of Bebop Deluxe, which, which is,
I did not expect that.
Yeah, it's another obscure band that probably isn't going to mean a lot to people, but
Bill Nelson was an awesome guitar player. You should look him up sometime.
Yeah, they're a great band, and they're not hair metal. They're considered more prog, but this song lands very much in that, like, you could compare the two, and I think they come across pretty close, but it felt weird to me. This feels like it would be the hit if they had a hit.
And it's once again, like, they just, nobody did this band any favors.
No.
You know, like,
and yet they launched so many careers.
Right? You're not gonna put one of these songs on the radio. And yeah, Radio Stars probably should have been a single.
Yeah.
I would really love to be able to find somebody who was in the lineup that recorded this record just to hear more about, like, what their time at Shrapnel was like, because it just seems like they got a deal and they got to put out the record and that was like it.
Yeah. It does seem like that. They put it out and then kind of like, you know, should we get gigs or something?
Yeah. I mean, trying to find info on this band is just,
it's pretty hard.
There's, you know, beyond they shed rock stars, beyond that, it's just really hard to find stuff.
Yeah, and I'm surprised with all the connections they had with musicians that you didn't see them, like, open for somebody bigger or something like that. You'd think they would, like, lobbied with their friends, like, hey, GNR, can we open for you?
And
or Motley Crue, can we open for you?
It's oddly difficult to find any sort of notes about that.
Yeah.
I mean, shit, by the time you get to their second record, they're on a label called Metalhead.
Right,
So they weren't even like, it's like, boy, everything was just set up for this band to just be like, nope, sorry, guys. Pshaw.
And so in that vein, do we have a vinyl history lesson?
We have a very brief vinyl history lesson. Because, it was never originally released on CD.
Oh, wait, let me do it. Let's do it properly.
Do it.
Then.
All right. I wasn't sure if we were actually going to do the thing, but yeah. So it works really fucking quick.
Yeah.
There was a US LP pressing, a Europe LP pressing on Roadrunner of all places. So they actually had a better label in Europe. Now, you know, in 85, Roadrunner wasn't being distributed in the US, I don't think, in any meaningful capacity. And then it was pressed in Japan.
Okay.
And that's it.
Okay.
And there's like, in 2009, there was a bootleg pressing issued in Italy. And then it finally got a CD reissue in 2018 in the US on a label called Vamps Worldwide that I've never heard of.
I've never heard of that either.
And there's a couple other bootleg Russia versions of it, and that's it. Like, this record just isn't anywhere. So I really, somebody clearly was able to license it for re-release. Yeah. But boy, you really have to wonder where it sits now.
Yeah. Well, and again, the re-release, I'm surprised that it wasn't marketed more heavily with all of the connections and things like that, these guys. I mean, I guess on this record, all you have is, like, Nikki Sixx, right? In terms of,
on this record, he had some writing credit, but the band on here is Nadir DePriest, Lizzie Gray, Brian West, and Bobby Marks.
Okay, so they didn't have any of the heavy hitters that played with them.
Well,
so
if you look on the back cover, there's a picture of Fred Curry on there, but he didn't play on it or anything like that.
That might be wise. I was going to say, you could put a sticker on it that had, like, Steven Adler's on this.
Right, because he was in the process, I believe, at this point of leaving to go join Cinderella. Because wasn't Night Songs 85, or was that 86? I don't remember. We didn't talk about Night Songs. I think it was 86, but all the same, he didn't play on that either. He was just pictured on it.
Yeah.
So yeah, like everything, boy, yeah. So the overall lesson here is it just seems like everything, even down to the new reissues, was just this band being set up to be ignored.
Yeah. Speaking, this is a little bit of a tangent, but speaking of Night Songs, I remember when we did the Lita Ford episode, we talked about Lizzie Hale from Hailstorm did a duet with Lita Ford on Close My Eyes Forever.
Yeah, I saw that.
She did another one with Tom Kiefer from Cinderella, and they did Nobody's Fool.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, right on.
I thought that was pretty cool. But anyway, I thought I'd throw it since we're mentioned Cinderella. It's worth checking out, too.
Huh. Yeah, I think Vamps Worldwide that did the reissue of Nonstop Rock is a vanity label for London, because I just looked up their discography and there are 6 releases and they are all London.
That tracks.
There's a CD of Nonstop Rock, a CD of Call That Girl, a live album, and Don't Cry Wolf, and that is their discography. Yeah. Wow.
So I'm guessing they don't have very good distribution on that as a result.
They must not. Because, you know, I remember before 2018 starting to look around, sniff around for copies of this, and as much targeted shit as I get and as much time as I spend just casting around looking at stuff, I saw no advertising for this reissue at all. And it's not even just because it was like a tiny label or anything like that, because there's all sorts of, you know, tiny vinyl reissue companies or CD or whoever, and I see their ads and stuff, and this one just nothing. I don't know, man. That just seems to be the theme of this band, is just no distribution, no notice.
Yeah. And in that vein too, I won't even push the Gear Talk button, because I did a cursory search and I found nothing at all. You know, usually you find at least something, but like, you know, the gear for this is like, you know, sporadic at best. So I figured we would just skip it. This will be a slightly shorter episode than normal, guys.
It is a slight episode this week, but it just seemed like something I just really want to make sure we covered, because as you established, this is sort of like a linchpin for a whole bunch of this other stuff that we talk about. So, I mean, somebody should pay attention to them, for fuck's sake.
Right. And as your self-appointed historians of hair metal, we felt like we needed to do this. So, anyway, thank you for listening, and thanks for bearing with us on this slightly more obscure episode. We'll get back to some of the bigger stuff pretty soon.
Right on. Catch you later, everybody. Hair metal.